This is Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide. Today, we're wrapping up DGR Week with our interview with Derek Jensen. We'll have music from Filthy Politicians, Sir X, and a rant from See More Life. This is Rage, Radio building a community of resistance, one podcast at a time. Hello, and welcome to Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide, coming to you from occupied Amiskwasee, Wiskaigan. I'm your host, Seymour Life. Today we round off DGR Week with our interview with renowned author and activist Derek Jensen. I want to say a deep thank you to Eric, Lier, and Derek for being on the show. It's great to know there are people who can put into words what many of us know in our hearts. I will also answer Derek's last question from his interview. As always, we have great music, and next week we'll have a show every other day. In our lineup is some of the folks from Fertile Ground, McDonald Stainsby of OilSandsTruth.org, and much, much more. It's been a great week, and thank you all for listening. And now for our interview with Derek. Hi, Derek, and welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
What was the reasoning or the process in which you became a writer?
A writer or an activist or both?
Well, we can do both.
As a writer, I always wanted to be a writer when I was a little kid. And when I was 5 and 6 and 7, we had a typewriter, and I would start typing out the beginnings of books, by which I don't mean I would start writing a book. What I would mean is that I would take a book I liked, like the Narnia series when I was a kid, and I would start typing it up. This was my writing at the time. And then I wrote some plays in elementary school, and some adaptations and short stories. And then when I was in high school, I was in the advanced math classes as well as the advanced English, and I got a scholarship to Colorado School of Mines. And, you know, if you can get a scholarship to School of Mines, you'd have to be crazy to go to a non-engineering school, because you're going to get a job, you know? That's a good way to make a living. And so I went to the School of Mines. I really didn't like it. I didn't enjoy myself. And I knew I really wanted to be a writer, but I didn't know how to go about that. So when I finished college, I quit engineering and became a beekeeper. One of the reasons I did that is because I love bees. Another reason is because I thought I could work very hard at some parts of the year at beekeeping, and then other parts of the year I would have a lot of time, and I recognized it takes a lot of time to develop the craft, writer. And so I did that for years. And then in my late 20s, I felt like I had learned about as much as I could from teachers of whom I could not ask questions, by which I mean, you know, reading the classics and reading lots of stuff. I felt like I learned as much as I could about writing without having teachers that I could actually, who were living beings, I could ask questions. And so I went back and got an MFA, and that was actually the only time I ever liked school. I had a great time, in part because I didn't care about grades. I only cared about learning. I was going there for one reason only, which was to learn how to write better. And the other is that I took charge of my own education, and the program was such that I could do that, that I decided I wanted a playwriting emphasis, a secondary emphasis in playwriting, and so they helped me set it up. They didn't have one. And so they helped set up, you know, I took classes with a drama teacher and so on. And so it was great. And then, you know, many more years of writing in the wilderness, as they say, where, you know, I'm writing and not getting published. Then finally, you know, stuff started turning around. We can talk more about that if you want, but I want to go back to the beginning and talk about becoming an activist. There were a couple things happened when I was a kid that really helped start that. One was that my father, as you know from my books, was very abusive. I recognized even as a kid that his destructive behavior was not making him happy. And I wasn't able to articulate this as a child, but I was thinking, if his behavior isn't making him happy, why is he doing it? I mean, it didn't make any sense to me. So I started really asking that question, and once again, not articulating that at 7 years old, but just still is in the air. And then also, well, one more thing about that, which is that in the process of my parents' divorce, I learned not to trust the court systems and also the church, because my parents were fundamentalist Christians. During the divorce, the church really took my father's side, and it let me know that churches could be hypocritical, which is an important lesson for someone to learn, and I learned it pretty young. And then also the court system. During the divorce, the judge was my father's tennis buddy, and my father's very wealthy, and the court system was very skewed. And so I learned a couple of very important lessons in my early teens, which were not to blindly trust churches and not to blindly trust courts, or rather, I learned that they're fallible, and then and can be manipulated. And then the next step in my activism was that going back to when I was a child, there was a subdivision went in near my home, and it destroyed these beautiful fields. I recognized, once again, I couldn't articulate this as a child, but I recognized really young that this can't go on forever. That if you have an economy, or if you have a system or whatever that is in which things get destroyed and you live on a finite planet, eventually everything is going to get destroyed. And that, I think, I probably was able to articulate, probably without the word finite or infinite, but I was able to articulate that at 7 or 8. And I really grasped that concept of this can't go on. It's always seemed to me extraordinarily stupid, this belief that you can have this infinite growth on a finite planet. I mean, there are prairie dogs in this area. Now they're not prairie dogs. Okay? So, I could see trends. That's what I'm trying to say. Right. As a child, I could see those trends pretty clearly of, the city is growing. Well, it can't grow forever. Sometime it's got to stop. And, okay, so now let's fast forward to when I was a teenager, and I still, was, believing the main myths of the culture. I still was a subscriber to the religion of capitalism and all that. Then when I was in college, I was very unhappy, like I said, and a lot of my fellow students were just as unhappy as I was. But when I would talk to them about it, they would say, well, yeah, I'm really unhappy. But when I get out of here, I'm going to buy myself a nice car. I've heard it said that a lot of activists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground. They end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization. Mm-hmm. And that happens because, you'll start asking questions like, why, like I said about, why is this area being destroyed? So you can ask these larger questions. Why the tar sands? Why does industry, and then you start to ask, okay, why does government serve industry rather than human beings? And then, the questions keep spiderwebbing their way out. They spiderweb back to the beginnings of civilization. And for me, in many ways, that part of the activism started because I was questioning a wage economy. Because I had this habit of asking people who like their jobs, but 90% say no.
Right.
And what does it mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? This seems crazy to me. It's an absolutely insane system that who is being served by this system? I was asking this question in those words when I was, 19, 20, 21. It wasn't making any sense. I didn't understand it. And if it would have made, if somebody could have explained it to me in a way that made sense that, it doesn't make any sense that you're going to waste your life so you can buy a car. I don't get it. And so why doesn't everybody, I had friends when I was in college. I had friends who were looking forward to the day they would retire. And that's crazy, to be wishing, you're 20 years old and you can't wait till you're 60.
Yeah.
And so I didn't want another wage economy. That was another big step. And then another big step for actually becoming an activist was, and I guess there's three more steps. One of them was when I was in my mid-20s, I realized I wasn't paying enough for gas. And so I would start, every time I would buy, because I wasn't taking into account the environmental damage. And so every time I would buy a tank of gas, I would contribute the same amount of money to an environmental organization, a local one, not a national one. But I didn't have any money at all. So instead, I would pay myself $5 an hour to do activism. So at the time, it cost about $10 to fill your car with gas. And so I would then, every time I filled my car with gas, I would do activism for 2 hours, write a letter to the editor, or go participate in a demo, or whatever. And that was one of the smartest things I ever did, because the problems are so big. How do we get started? I mean, we all know that everything's messed up.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we get started? That was a great way for me to actually do something. And that's the big dividing line. It's not between militant and non-militant resistance or grassroots and national organizing. None of those are the real dividing line. The real dividing line is between those who do something and those who do nothing. And so it got me started. And then two more. There's, one of them is, a couple years into that sort of ad hoc activism, I met this guy, John Osborne, who was at the time the heart and soul of the Spokane environmental community. And he really channeled my energy, and he helped me find a place to put my energy, and was able to, I like the word channel in a good sense, not channel like putting concrete around a river, but taking sort of a diffuse energy and then directing it. And so I started working on forest issues with the Public Lands Council in Spokane, all volunteer. And I did that for several years. And the last thing I want to mention about the activism is, you know, I already recognized once again that the whole system is messed up, and it's all set up to serve the powerful, and the powerful make the laws, and the powerful then get cops to enforce the laws, and it's all just a big scam. And I recognize that, but one of the things that hit me pretty hard or made it very clear was something called the salvage rider. And that's about 1995, I think, that we forest activists had been really shutting down the national forest by filing timber sale appeals. And what that is, timber sale appeals, where when the Forest Service would put out a timber sale, they would have to put out documentation. And then we would look through the documentation, find their lies, find the places where they're violating the law, and then we would say, you know, on page 62, you're violating the National Environmental Protection Act, you know, line 4, and here's how. And, you know, page 79, you're violating the National Forest Management Act, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's incredibly boring work. It's really tedious and really awful. And we would do this, and of course, all the timber sales were illegal, and we would catch them on their lies, and activists all over the country were shutting down forests. And we were also at the same time saying that the forests are in a state of ecological collapse. You've got to stop cutting. Mm-hmm. And what the timber industry did was, the timber industry and Congress, which, you know, they end up working together, and oftentimes they're the same people in revolving doors. Anyway, the timber industry did a pretty smart sort of jiu-jitsu thing, and they said, yeah, you're absolutely right. The forests are in a state of ecological collapse, which means we need to cut them down before they get sicker, because that's the only way to make them more healthy is to cut them down and start over. And it's like they're infected, so you got to kill them to save the other trees. So Congress passed a law that said that, called the salvage rider, that said that any timber sale that was necessary to improve forest health would not be susceptible to environmental regulation, which on its surface makes absolutely no sense, of course. I mean, if it's really necessary for forest health, then of course you should follow environmental regulations for all the more reason. But that wasn't the point. The point was to pass the law, and they did. And the Forest Service then put out all the timber sales that we'd helped stop. I had personally been associated with stopping probably, I don't know, 10 or 20,000 acres of old growth from being cut. And as soon as they passed that law, the Forest Service put those back out, exact same timber sale, but now they just put a rubber stamp on the front that said necessary for forest health. Wow. And there was nothing we could do. And the lesson here is, any time that you learn how to use their rules in order to stop them from committing some atrocity, they will change the rules on you. And it's a great way to radicalize people, is to have them play by the rules and then screw them. And that's exactly what happened. That's what happens every time, you know, no matter what the subject is. I mean, if you figure out how to actually use the rules to bring justice to a circumstance, they will change the rules, which lets you know that the purpose of the rules was a sham in the first place. It wasn't really about rules. I mean, that's the thing, is that all the United States would have to do to stop a lot of problems is simply enforce laws that are already on the books, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act. What's the one, anti-monopoly? It's the Hatch Act or something? I don't remember what it's called right now. But there's some, they can enforce monopoly laws that are already there. And, you know, it doesn't happen. It's very much, it's like a friend of mine says, she doesn't call police law enforcement officers, she calls them selective law enforcement officers. And so that was very radicalizing for me to have done that work in good faith.
Yeah.
And then to find out that that's how they work. And then, of course, I looked at the history a lot more, and I found out that this was not a unique situation. This is what they do all the time. And in fact, since that time, the Forest Service and the other parts of the federal government have, I mean, it was, for a while it was Forest Health, and then after that was Salvage Logging. I don't remember, it was one of the other. No, Salvage Logging was first, and then Forest Health, and then Fire Reduction. You know, it's like they keep coming up with all these excuses why they need to cut. And the prescription is always the same, no matter what their stated cause is.
Right.
And something, one more thing about this, which is that something that was very helpful for me was to learn from Robert J. Lipton. He said that before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to convince yourself that what you're doing is good. You have to have what he calls a claim to virtue. And that's what all of those are, that they're all claim to virtues on committing these destructive acts.
Yeah, that's interesting point, because one of the questions I have for you is about, I guess it ties into the objectification of things. When this, that's a slightly different way of, you're going beyond justification and some objectification, you're actually going to putting virtue beside it. But let me ask you that question about objectification. In the culture of make-believe, which I'm reading right now, you discuss with John Keeble, I believe that his name is, the relationship between hate groups and transnational corporations. And you quote him as saying, nobody talks about this. They are branches of the same tree, just different forms of the same culture imperative. And that is, the imperative is to rob the world of its subjectivity. I see a lot of, in your talks and in your other writings as well, that the issue of subjectivity versus objectivity. And I was wondering if you can go more into why subjectivity is important and why do they want to rob the world of it?
Well, I think it's in many ways the central question, or it's one of the central questions. I mean, so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that for indigenous peoples, the world consists of other beings to enter into relationship with, and for Westerners, for the non-Indigenous, the world consists of objects to be exploited. There's a great line by a Canadian lumberman, when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. And if when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them a different way. And if when you look at this particular tree, you see a neighbor with whom you can enter into a relationship, that you're going to treat it differently still. It's this huge inversion. There's an article in the local Crescent City newspaper about why crabbers work so hard during the season. And the harbor master said, well, you know, each crab is worth about $3.50. So if you just imagine all these envelopes, each envelope has $3.50 in it, of course you can go pick up as many as you can. And he has stated right there the problem. Those crabs are actually beings with lives just as valuable to them as yours is to you and mine is to me. And it's much easier to exploit someone if you don't consider them a them. If they're not a real being, if they're an it. And this culture, the objectification in this culture is so extreme and so total that, well, for one thing, they can kill the planet and not seem to care. And also that the notion of having a conversation with a tree, that's one of the, in the DSM-4, one of the signals of being, I don't remember which mental illness it is that you hear voices when no one else is in the room. And I'm presuming that they would count having a radio or television in the room as having someone in the room, even though there's nobody there. If you hear that voice, that's okay. But if you hear voices from trees or a muse or a dream giver or river or a dog, then that's crazy. I mean, and it's also really absurd because we all know that non-humans can communicate very, very well. I mean, do you have a dog or cat or anything?
Oh yeah, I have 4 cats and 1 dog.
Okay, so if your dog's water dish is empty, how does the dog let you know?
Comes and nudges me with his nose.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And then what mine would do is he looks at the dog at the water dish.
Mm-hmm.
He looks at me with the water dish. That's how I'm supposed to get it. You know?
Yeah.
And I had a dog a couple years ago. He died a couple years ago. I had a dog for a long time. But I park at my mom's house, and I go inside, and I put the keys inside. And then when I go to come home, I would walk home. And when I would go, and the dog would come with me. But if I would go to get in the car, the dog wouldn't even get up off the porch. And it took me a couple years to figure out the difference. And I mean, he figured out right away which is which. I couldn't tell. How does he know whether I'm going home or whether I'm getting in the car? And then I realized it's because if I walk out of the house holding keys in my hand, then he knows I'm getting in the car, so he didn't bother to get up. And it took me literally 3 or 4 years to figure that out when he figured it out within a couple of days. And, you know, so there are these communications going on, and that's just on a superficial level, and they're having to learn your language, you know, as opposed to you. I mean, it's like, it just it kills me that, you know, all those studies about teaching chimps American Sign Language, and then, you know, gosh, can they really communicate? Is it really communication? It's like, I'm sorry, which of these creatures is bilingual? You know, the chimp has had to learn your, I mean, how would you do if you got kidnapped by a bunch of chimpanzees, they put you in a trailer house, and then started trying to teach you chimp? How long would it take you to learn it? I think the chimps are really way, way smarter than we are that way. Anyway, so the point is that this notion that there are other beings to enter into relationship with as opposed to other just objects that are to be exploited. You know, how much are you worth if we can cut you into little pieces and sell your flesh and fat and bone? I mean, that's how utility is mentioned. I mean, that's how this culture has a utilitarian perspective. You know, what good is a Delta smelt?
Yeah.
And that attitude leads to absolutely grotesque insanity. You know, there's this horrible, horrible line from this horrible, horrible movie that has always stuck with me. I saw it when I was 19 or 20. And the movie's called The Boy and His Dog. It's a horrible, wretched, misogynist movie, post-apocalyptic. And it's, you know, there are mainly men around and not many women. And the women who are there, they get raped immediately. And early in the movie, this guy comes across the body of a woman. And damn, that's really too bad. And you're thinking at first, it's like, oh, you know, I feel sorry for her. Says, damn, it's really too bad. She had a couple uses left in her.
Mm.
And that line, I think, perfectly describes the dominant culture's approach to everyone and everything. That I think the capitalists, at the very end, they're not going to be going, wow, that was really stupid. They're going to be going, ah, damn, you know, there's still a couple fish over there we could have sold.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to try to squeeze every last dollar they can out of this living planet before they kill it, or in the process of killing it.
I want you to describe, what is the psychopath that you're talking, what is the psychopath and why are you using that in this terms?
Well, I remember maybe a year ago, I was watching some program about some serial killer, and he had kidnapped, tortured, and killed a lot of women. One of that FBI profiler on there who was talking about, you know, what was wrong with him that made him do that. And one of the things that this person said was that when he sees a woman, or when he's done with a woman, he throws her away just like he would a Kleenex, that she has no subjective existence. As soon as she said that, the first thing I thought was salmon, because all these others have no subjective existence and they're just there for you to use. And that's, I guess, a sociopath would be someone who has no conscience and is absolutely narcissistic, doesn't perceive the others as subjective beings, and has no qualms about harming or killing these others. And, you know, there's a distinction, of course, between killing others for food. And because we all have to kill to eat, which is true whether you're killing a carrot. I mean, I don't make that hierarchical distinction between animals and animals and vegetables or minerals for that matter, that they all have lives that are valuable to them. And we can have different rules associated with them, but we shouldn't kid ourselves that, you know, a carrot gives itself to us any more than a salmon might and a carrot might, but the point is that they do have lives that are their own. And what a sociopath misses is that those others do have lives. And, you know, somebody can say, well, you know, humans are different. Well, first off, there's a rampant disease in this culture of human supremacism, which is no less horrid than white supremacism or male supremacism. But another thing to think about with this is that, you know, just a couple of days ago, there was the attempted bombing on that plane that was in response by a Yemeni person that was in response to the United States bombing Yemen. And now the United States, based on this guy's unsuccessful attempt to blow up a plane, is now planning on bombing Yemen a bunch more. It's like, I don't understand why the United States gets to blow up everybody. And if anybody tries something, I mean, I do, of course, I've written about it. But I mean, that's part of the whole sociopathy thing, is that the rules only go one way.
Yeah.
I am the doer, and you are the done too. And that's a pretty central part of sociopathy. And also, there's this huge need for control, and that's pretty central to sociopathy too.
Mm-hmm.
An absolute fetish of control. And of course, when we look around, this is what we see the dominant culture doing, is attempting to control everything and attempting and in the process destroying everything. A parking lot is much easier to control than a living forest.
Fits well, I think.
There's one more thing.
Sure.
That's one of the things that I have been. One of the reasons that I write the books I do is because I saw holes in discourse. You know, I saw that there were things that were being missed by other people, and instead of complaining about them missing them, I just, you know, set out to do it myself. And people should do the same thing with my work. If there's parts of my analysis that are missing, you know, people should write their own damn books. That's what I did. You know, I saw stuff I didn't like, so I wrote my own damn books. And one of the things I saw was missing to the analysis was that the culture really does have this sort of fundamental death urge, that the problems we face are not rational, and therefore they're not rational to, I'm sorry, the problems we face are not rational, and therefore they're not amenable to rational solution. It's not rational to kill the planet, to consume the planet that you're attempting to live on. That just doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not rational to think you can have finite growth on it. I mean, infinite growth on a finite planet. And it's not rational to destroy every indigenous culture you encounter. I mean, this makes no sense. You know, those are actions of a very disturbed cultural mind.
Yeah.
And that's really, really central to my analysis, and it's central to my suggestions for solutions, because if the problems are fundamentally rational, then you can solve the problems by simply providing information. If you and I are having a dispute, and, you know, you keep stepping on my foot, and that keeps making me mad, and then I keep punching you in the arm because you stepped on my foot, then we can say this, and we can say, you know, I don't like it when you punch me in the arm. I can say, well, I don't like it when you step on my foot. And we can come to some sort of, you know, agreement where I will stop punching the arm if you stop stepping my foot, or maybe you're stepping my foot because you didn't know my foot was there. So I provide the information, hey, my foot's right here, please don't step on it. You mm-hmm. don't. But what if you're attempting to inflict pain? What if the truth is that you want to steal my land? What if you want to drive me, you know, we're both sitting in the same room, you want to drive me out of the room? You're going to keep stepping on my foot. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But if the problems are not amenable to rational, I mean, if the problems are not rational, then we have a whole different solution set we have to go to.
How do you think that the cult of science became such a powerful mindset? How is it that it separates us from what Martin Bartel calls our indigenous soul?
Well, I think one of the ways that science has become so ascendant is that it doesn't give back, and that gives you a competitive advantage in the short run. So a way to think about this is that if you're spending all of your, if you have two cultures or two different groups of people, people A live on one side of a river and people B live on the other. And people B have been spending all of their time making songs and learning how to interpret dreams and learning how to live sustainably. And they do take trees, but they know that they're planning on living there forever, and so they don't take more trees than the forest will give easily. That's one group, group A. B is on the other side of the river, and they're planning on conquering everybody else. And so they don't mind cutting down their own trees to make big war machines because they know that there are plenty of trees on the other side of the river. So they build a bunch of war machines, they cut down their trees, and they build a bunch of war machines, and then they build a bunch of chariots, and then they build big shields, and then they build a bridge across, and they invade the other country or the other people. And so which of these peoples will probably be better equipped to fight?
Which one will be actually equipped to fight The other person? Well, the one who made the shields and built the bridge and did the industrial.
Yeah. So the energy that you spend on making war machines, if you're spending all your energy, or if you're not spending the energy at all, if you're just living in place and you're not making war machines and these other people are making war machines, they can conquer you. They have that competitive advantage. The disadvantage from their perspective is they have to keep conquering because they've destroyed their own land base. So it creates this ongoing problem of they run through land base, which of course is what we've seen with the dominant culture, that the, you know, Iraq was, before the beginning of this culture, Iraq was cedar forest so thick the sunlight never touched the ground. And the Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna, and the Near East was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. Italy was heavily forested. The forests of North Africa went down to make the Phoenician and Egyptian navies.
Yeah.
And those were then very powerful navies that allowed them to conquer more. And so the point is that if your actual epistemology, if your belief of what is true is based on your ability to make others jump through hoops on command, that is one version of truth. That is one version. That is one epistemology. Another epistemology is sort of the how we know things. But what I say in the book is that that's Richard Dawkins' definition of truth, is the ability to make others jump through hoops on command. Well, my definition of truth is if you can live in place with something for 12,500 years, then maybe it's true. By which I mean the Talawa Indians lived here for 12,500 years without destroying the place. The dominant culture has been here for 180, and the place is trashed. And the dominant culture has been able to trash places because it is based on making others jump through hoops on command, as opposed to being based on entering into relationships with these others. And that's one of the ways that science has been able to conquer is by, okay, let's put you and me in a room again, okay?
Okay.
You and I guess. Yeah. You and I are in a room.
Yeah.
And you are perfectly principled. And you will never hit me first. You will never hit below the belt. You will always warn me before you're going to hit me. And you will only use your fists.
Right.
Okay? And you don't even want to fight. You know, normally, you'll just like, if we get in a big fight, you'll like call me a name. You know, that's your idea of fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you might, you know, sort of tap me or something. I, on the other hand, have a bunch of guns that I brought into this room.
Right.
And I also have no conscience. And I have no issues with killing you. And you have food, and I have food, but I actually want your food too. Who's probably going to win this fight?
You will, definitely, yeah.
Yeah. So basically I've just said the same thing as I did about the cultures, you know?
Right.
That there's a great line by, I think it was Red Cloud. He said, they made as many promises, more than I can remember, and they only kept but one. They promised they would take our land, and they did it. And how do you deal with a culture that systematically lies? And how do you deal with a culture? That's how they've been able to beat everybody else. They systematically lie, and they systematically make bigger war machines. And they systematically... Oh, there's a great line. I don't remember who said it. Huntington is the name. He said basically that people in the West think that they have won the world by the strength of their ideas. But people in the rest of the world understand that the West is won by its capacity for committing mass organized violence.
Yeah.
And people in the Western world always forget that. People in the rest of the world never forget that.
Yeah.
And so why has science been so successful? And that's part of it. Another part is that one of the things that I've taken to saying is that science is an even more effective means of social control than Christianity ever was. Because if you don't believe in Christianity, you just go to a hell that you don't really believe in. But if you don't believe in science, you must be just plain stupid. Because one of the things that science has done that's really, really smart is they have made it. So how do you determine? Well, okay, so this is not a rhetorical question, again, but okay. There is actually one correct answer.
All right.
How do you show that something, what rules do you use to show that something is or is not scientifically true at this point? What rules do you use? Right. Rules of?
Science. You have to use the rules of science to, or an experiment of some sort, a scientific
right.
method.
So something basically is shown to be true scientifically by the rules of science, but what do scientists say to Christians when, if they say, how do you know that God is true? They say, well, because, I mean, how do you know that the Bible is true? They say, because God says it's true. Where? In the Bible. And so scientists laugh their heads off when they find Christians being self-referential in this way. But at the same time, that's exactly what science is. Science is self-referential. You use the rules of science to determine whether something is true. Another part, another thing that science has been able to do that's absolutely extraordinary is to get it to be conflated with knowledge. That if I say that I think science is very harmful and dangerous, immediately people like, what, are you superstitious? What, you don't believe in knowledge? What, you don't believe in curiosity?
Yeah.
That's an absolutely extraordinary thing. No, I actually do believe in knowledge and curiosity. What I don't believe is that the universe consists of objects that can be, in all cases, described mathematically. And I do believe, I mean, it's insane. It just cracks me up that there's this notion that if you can't establish cause and effect, then, you know, it can't be. And, well, first off, you know, 300 years ago, nobody knew that there were such things as x-rays. And there were still cause and effects going on, but people just didn't know them. But second, it stuns me that people will say they so rigorously believe in cause and effect. Well, if that's the case, why haven't you brought down this culture? Because cause and effect, this culture is burning oil and gas that is killing a planet. And this culture is systematically destroying the planet. We can show cause and effect on this, but you're not stopping it. So it's like, why is there this double standard? Why is it that if we want to show the existence of a muse, we have to rigorously show cause and effect, but when it comes time to actually maybe not put in more dams or to stop burning oil and gas that's killing the planet, then suddenly you don't believe in cause and effect anymore? Suddenly you believe that we can wave our magic wands and have nanotechnology save the day? It's like, who's believing in the tooth right now? I mean, it's an absolutely stunning double standard.
Yeah. No.
I was doing a video talk the other day, and it was like 20 adults in the room and 3 children. And I asked this probably 7-year-old, or no, I think she's about 10. I said, so how would you stop global warming that's caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas? And this little kid said, stop burning oil and gas. And I said, you know what? You're smarter than Al Gore.
Yeah. 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 It's an amazing thing. And one of the things I've always sort of thought about, that you could, it's a science, statistics, in the Bible, and you can pretty much prove anything you want using any one of those things and whatever belief you put in them. Because it seems like it's, if you, well, with science in it, is that you can twist and turn things around. You know, it's like, if you look at this way or look at that way, it depends on how you just set up your experiment. And then you got a different truth.
Not only that, what you've done with your experiment in the first place is you have abstracted from the real world.
Yes, exactly.
What an experiment is an attempt to, I mean, you're getting rid of the entire world to study one cause and effect, and then you're generalizing that back to the real world. That's a problematical approach. And I'm not saying, I want to be really clear, because people are so invested in the cult of science, I want to be really clear that I'm not saying I'm against knowledge. I'm not saying that information that has been gained through the scientific method is not information, because it is information, but it is one form of information. And it is, once again, it's based on certain premises, and those premises are often not examined. And one of the premises is that there is no free will among those to be studied, that no choices are being made. And that's a very, very dangerous premise.
Yeah, I can see that.
And also presumes that you can understand things. I mean, it's just crazy to do. I mean, why are they doing all these studies about forest management when they keep cutting down the forest? It's like the first thing you should do, I mean, if you really, I mean, what's the point of studying the forest as you cut them down? I mean, that's an absolutely extraordinary thing. I mean, the first thing that the forest wants is to be left alone.
Right.
And sung to and all that. But that's, you know, at the very least, it wants to be left alone. It wants you to stop cutting off its limbs.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, as you say, you're altering it as soon as you start cutting it. So how can you actually know what it is if you just start manipulating it from the beginning?
Right.
Also, too, is a sort of blind faith that exists in science that it will come up with a solution for us, or we've been down bad roads before, and science has come up with a solution just like that for us. So, and I think you talk about this in because the other you talked about in there, and one of the things is technologies that you didn't know you tend to call magic, right? And so the indigenous groups tend to look at guns as magic, but then in turn the community healing.
Thinking about that is that, and this goes back to one of the reasons the dominant culture has won is because of its definition of technology. That technology has been basically, I think, in Welcome to the Machine, George Raffel and I talk about how a machine is an artifact which can include a social order that has as its function the conversion of raw material to power.
Mm.
And that's a pretty good workable definition of any machine.
Yeah.
And same with the social order called the machine, following Lewis Mumford, where the dominant culture is a machine. The whole social order is set up to convert raw materials to power. And that's one definition of technology, is those artifacts that can convert raw materials to power. But then in What We Leave Behind, we talk there about how you could have another definition of technology that would include songs, or the ability to include to interpret dreams, or the ability to be able to read what the salmon wants, and the ability to respond to the salmon.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this one culture I was reading about that they all dream the same dream. And then they will wake up and they had a communal dream. And I hear about people, attempting to sort of focus energy, or, use some sort of, do a sweat lodge, and then we'll all be pure and we can go, something good will happen.
Mm.
And I think it's really disrespectful to those people that have had these intact communities that would work on these forms of technologies of dream interpretation or self-governance for thousands of years. And one of the things I say in What We Leave Behind about that is that I can drive a car, but I could not build one by myself. It takes an entire infrastructure to do so. And why would we think that I can suddenly conjure up magic because without communal support, without the entire community and the entire history, and that entire bank of knowledge that will, in these indigenous cases, go back 10,000 more years. And so one of the things I tried to do in that book is to contrast that, what I think, very real notion of magic, the ability to ask for and enter into relationships with, unseen beings, with a muse. When I talk about a muse, I'm talking about a real being.
Right.
And there is actually someone who gives me dreams. And that's what the whole dreams book is about in many ways. And, that's an entirely different way to look at the universe than to, once again, to look at it. The universe is a big machine that you are manipulating parts inside of. Oh, and where this falls apart is that then the magical thinking thing, I think, is actually a toxic mimic, which preserves the form and perverts the content of real magic. And magical thinking would be the notion that my thoughts are, they can substitute for reality. So if I just, a bunch of people getting naked and then forming a peace sign on a hill is actually going to affect physical reality.
Yeah.
And, we can send out, we can change the vibrations by just all thinking nice thoughts. So we all, dial in and meditate at 9 o'clock at night for world peace, that's actually a substitute for destroying munitions factories. And that's just, maybe a better word than magical thinking would be wishful thinking. That's really what it is.
Yeah. And why do you think there's so much of that right now? Is that because people feel so disempowered and that this is the last thing they have left?
Well, it's a combination, I think, of feeling disempowered and also having privilege. Mm. Because I don't want them to take away my space heater. You know, I don't want... And we see what happens to those who effectively resist. And so we can come up with all sorts of rationalizations for our own cowardice. And that's an important part. And another part, is the problem so big? And there's this... When you have an abusive family, everyone in that family plays their own role in maintaining the abusive dynamic. And every person in that, they all play these different roles. And the central organizing factor of these roles is they're all doing everything they can to maintain that structure, even though it's abusive. The same thing will happen on the larger scale. That we recognize this, but I mean, it's just extraordinary to me that you get all these, you know, Lester Brown and his Plan B to save civilization. You get Peter Montague saying that, I mean, even reasonably intelligent people, like Peter Montague, whose work I really admire, he was saying that one reason carbon sequestration is a really bad idea is because if all the carbon escaped at once, it could, in his words, quote, disrupt civilization as we know it. It's like, no, Peter, if it all escaped at once, it would kill life on the planet.
Yeah.
And it's the same with so many people. They just they won't question identity. They identify more with civilization than they do with the planet itself and with life. And that's an absolutely extraordinary and very typical. I guess it's not extraordinary at all. It's a very ordinary. That's what happens within an abusive dynamic, is you end up identifying with the abuser. And one of the first and most important things we have to do, as so many indigenous people have said, is to decolonize our hearts and minds. To first off, no longer identify with civilization. I am not civilization. It's not my fault. And then once I've separated from it, I can fight it. And I can fight it much more effectively because I'm no longer fighting myself at the same time.
Because that's something that in your latest article in the Orion magazine, you know, that you talk about, and people say, well, okay, Derek, what do you want us to do? I mean, that in itself is a problem because people are still sitting around saying, tell me what to do. But
you know, I get notes once in a while from people writing to me about an entirely local issue, like a local golf course going in or something,
mm-hmm.
and they want me to stop it. And it's in their town, but you know, I've never even heard the name of their town before today.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm not Superman. I'm not Batman. I mean, there's no superheroes. There's no superheroes going to come to our rescue. You got to do it yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Why decolonization, and what does that actually look like? Besides saying I'm not in it.
Well, that's pretty much it, and everything else is just around the edges. And let's go with what first, and what is to recognize that technological progress is not actually technological progress, but it's escalation. To recognize that there are other ways to live, and that the Talawa Indians lived where I live now for 12,500 years.
Right.
And it's to recognize that other beings have their own lives, and this culture does not have the right to destroy everything. This culture does not have the right to destroy anything. And it's to recognize that the world was not created for this culture, and the world was not created for humans. And it's to recognize that we are living, we members of this culture are living on stolen land. That land was stolen here from the Talawa, and it was also stolen from the salmon. But mainly it's to recognize that to recognize that there are other ways to be. And as soon as you recognize there are other ways to be, then that leads to the question, well, why live this way that is destroying the planet? And then you can start making rational, reasonable decisions about it. Because as long as you think that this culture is the only way to be, or as long as you identify this culture with life, you will never be able to stop this culture. I mean, that's one of the things. There are so many people, like so many global warming activists who say, gosh, you know, we need to stop burning so much oil and gas. We need to get carbon levels down so we can save civilization. what they don't recognize is that civilization has been systematically, functionally destroying the planet, like I said, for the last 6,000 years.
Right.
And that's, and once you break your identification with civilization, and you care, there's the thing, is to care more for the land where you live than for this culture. That's really the bottom line. And what does that mean? What that means is that it changes everything in how you look at resistance, because if you still identify with the culture, then you are going to be fighting yourself at the same time you're fighting the culture. I mean, think about this. What would, if Delta Smelt could take on human manifestation for 24 hours, what they would do is destroy the pumps on the Sacramento River.
Yeah.
No doubt. Who is one non-human who is being extraordinarily harmed? I mean, name one or two non-human species who are being extraordinarily harmed by the tar sands. Okay, well, we'll just say the land itself. The land around there that is being actually torn up and turned into a moonscape, if that land had opposable thumbs, if that land could take on human manifestation for 48 hours, what would that land do?
Oh, it would certainly stop it immediately. I mean, it's, yeah.
And it would presumably use any means necessary.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that happens when you decolonize, is suddenly things open up. And it becomes more a technical question. What am I, you know, what can I do? What do I love to do? What are my gifts? How can I use these gifts? And a great example of this is in What We Leave Behind, I talk about how we fought some developers, and we more or less won. Actually, we held off the developers long enough that the housing market crash came, and so the land is only partially destroyed. But so we held them off until economics did it for us. Thank you, Bernie Madoff. And I was talking to, I mean, in all my books, I talk about my definition of hope. And hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. This is the definition I use. Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. And that's how we use it in everyday language. You know, next time I get on the plane, I hope it doesn't crash because I'll be in the air. But when I was doing that talk with those with the however many adults and three children, at one point I said to, I think the 7-year-old this time, I said, so what would your parents say if they said to you, you better clean your room, or please clean your room, and then you said back to them, I hope the room gets cleaned, and everybody in the room laughed, and the parents laughed, of course, and said this would not work, and the kids shouted out, somebody has to clean it, and it's like, same deal, you know, you're way smarter than any environmentalist I ever heard of. But the point is that, the point is that my definition of hope is a longing for a future condition over which we have no agency. So I don't hope coho salmon survive, because there are things I can do, and I'll do whatever it takes. But so if we hope, there are things that are beyond our control. So if we were to take down the entire oil infrastructure, we would still have to hope that no tipping points have been reached, that, you know, methane is going to burp out and it's all over anyway.
Right.
But for us to allow the oil economy to continue and hope that global warming doesn't consume the planet is logic that a reasonably intelligent 7-year-old can see through. Also, the point with the developer is I was doing this talk in Fort Collins, Colorado, and afterwards this philosophy professor came up to me and said, you know, I disagree with your whole notion about hope, because the truth is, at some point in your fight with the developer, you had to hope that a governmental organization would do the right thing. I said, no, it's not true. He said, yes, it is. I said, no, it isn't. He said, yes, it is. We weren't going very far, very fast with that. I said, no, because I could always have killed him. And he said, no, you couldn't. I said, yes, I could. He said, no, I couldn't. I said, yes, I could. I didn't say I'm going to. And in fact, I didn't.
Right.
But, and I never considered it. I daydreamed about it, but I didn't consider it.
Right.
And that doesn't alter the fact that me choosing to not kill him is a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And we have choices, and every day we are making the choice to not bring down civilization. And every day we are making the choice to not destroy oil infrastructure. And that's fine. You know, I'm not telling other people what choices they should make.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every day I'm also choosing not to, you know, walk through Walmart with underwear on my head, you know? And I'm not suggesting that I or anybody else walk through Walmart with water, underwear on my head. What I'm saying is that we make choices, whether we recognize so or not.
Right.
And simply because we face morally complex choices at this point, withdrawal or inaction is no response to a morally complex question. Withdrawal or inaction is a choice itself, and it carries with it moral and real-world consequences. And one of the things that happens when you start to decolonize is you start to look at things, you get some perspective because you're no longer in the system. It's like I was sharing a stage with three other activists, and we're all recognizing we don't live in a democracy, and everybody knows, it's like 400 or 500 people in the audience, and everybody recognizes we don't live in a democracy. And yet all of us on the panel were talking about our activism as though we live in a democracy. And at one point I asked the audience, how many people in here believe that the government takes better care of corporations or human beings? Every single one of the 500 people raised their hand that takes better care of corporations.
Yeah.
But we're all sitting there acting as though our activism is in a democracy. We're all still, but what we're doing is petitioning the king. And at one point I turned to this activist to my left, who's this great anti-war activist. I said, so if you wanted to stop U.S. invasions of Iraq or Afghanistan, and if you recognize we don't live in a democracy, how would that affect your activism? And she said, I have no idea. And that's part of it too, is we all have this belief that governments are somehow going to work out if we just petition them enough times to not support the corporations they're set up to support. And if you break out of that, you start to see more options. It's something I wrote. And unless you have a different question, this might actually be a good thing to end on.
Okay.
You have another question? Or is this...
Well, no, I mean, you were hitting on another point already that I had as a question, and that was just that, about the you know, pointing out that we don't live in a democracy and the fact that nobody believes that we're going to voluntarily change to a... you know, sane and
well, yeah, okay.
Sustainable.
Well, let's talk about both of those. First,
okay.
I wrote something a few weeks ago that I have to – good thing I'm on this phone because now I can walk to the house because it's in the other room. It's in a notebook. Okay. Glasses. Before we can begin to use power on our own terms, we must realize we are powerless on theirs. Much of the brilliance of the democratic experiment is to con the powerless into believing they have power. Finally, it becomes clear to even the most obtuse that we, the people, are powerless in this great democracy. The next turn of the screw was to con us into, my handwriting, was to convince us that our power lies in our power to consume or in our inner power to be enlightened. But only when we realize that we are powerless in all these ways will we be moved to use power in ways that do affect change. So one of the things we have to do is to recognize that we have no power in the system. And it's like, okay, now we can do about it. And then find out ways you do have power and use them. And so the next question, do you believe the culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane, sustainable way of living? No, of course not. I mean, I see no indications going the right direction. I see no indications that the culture will voluntarily transform. If people have not been convinced before, Copenhagen should have convinced them.
Yeah.
I mean, this culture will not change. And, you know, passenger pigeons should have convinced you of that, or Eskimo curlews, or bison, or, you know, what's your threshold? I mean, I've said this to people before. It's like, and you know, I want to say this to Bill McKibben, actually, that right now, you know, carbon levels are at 390, and he wants them down to 350.
Yeah.
And what I would want to ask him very respectfully, because he's been doing this work for a long time. He's got great stamina. He has done probably more than, you know, he, James Hansen, and Al Gore have done more to publicize global warming than anybody else I can think of.
Right.
So I'm in no way disrespecting him with this, but I would want to ask him, at what point do you give up on, no, not give up on, because you can still do it, but at what point do you expand the range of tactics that you are calling for to include destruction of oil infrastructure?
Mm-hmm.
Is it at 410 parts per million, 430, 450, 470, 490, 510? he put out an article right after Copenhagen that they did the numbers, and if governments actually do everything they say they're going to do, they agreed to at Copenhagen, do you know what carbon levels will be by in the next by 90 more years?
No, I didn't see that.
770.
Oh, my God.
Hell is the word that Bill McKibben used. So it's like, okay, at what level, at what time? I mean, there's a great Star Trek line from when I was a kid. I remember this, that one of the in one of the episodes, Spock has he shouts, or he does, you know, he has this outburst, and after, and it saves the day, and then afterwards everybody looks at him and he says, I reasoned it was time for an outburst. And you know, I think about that with myself, that I have come to the conclusions I've come to about civilization, about this culture being sociopathological, not really emotionally. I've come to them just through thinking, you know, and it's pretty straightforward, pretty simple pattern, really. And one reviewer said of my work, and I actually really like this, they said that I was almost pathologically unsentimental.
Mm.
And I really like that because I'm very emotional, and there's a difference between emotion and sentiment, you know? Mm. But I don't feel I'm sentimental, and I don't have a sentimental attachment to this culture. That real life is more important to me than this culture. So anyway, back to the question, if you, you know, what is the threshold? 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone. You know, what's the threshold at which you give up on this culture? 91%, 92%, 93%? You know, is it when the Delta smelt are gone, the call of salmon, the Kootenai sturgeon?
Yeah.
Is it when the great apes are gone? Is it when the frogs are gone? You know, what's the threshold at which you will fight back in whatever ways are appropriate for you to fight back?
No, well, I can understand that. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this radio piece that I'm doing, is because that, you know, I was just saying to Lear last night, it says no one's talking about this. No one is. I work for a news organization. I know what they put out there. I know how they do it. It's gobbledygook. It's not, you know, we have much bigger issues and we're not talking about it at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not talking about the death of the planet, and 70,000 people show up for a Minnesota Vikings Chicago Bears game, you know? And that you want to know why there's not going to be voluntary transformation?
Yeah, that's why.
Or there was a thing on 60 Minutes a couple days ago, really made me mad. And I never watched 60 Minutes. I hate it so much. There was a thing about what's going on with water in California. Mm. And they interviewed four people. The first one was a scientist the first one was a farmer who said, you know, the Delta smelt are the problem. You know, those fish, farmers are the real endangered species. And wait a second. I mean, he said they're driving me out of business. Like, wait a second. You know, your business has been based on drawing water, on stealing water from the river. And now that there's no more water, I mean, what was it I said about that horrible movie, A Boy's Dog? It's like, you saw a couple uses in it. It's like, he's complaining about the fish, that the fish are the victimizers, the fish are the abusers because he can't continue to abuse the way he always has. The second one was a scientist who, it's interesting because he handed her a container of dead smelt, and she said, basically, so those are the fish that are causing all the problems. Okay? And they had Schwarzenegger, a governor of California, who I'll talk about in a second.
Yeah.
But the third person they had was this guy who is pulling out, he said, $14 million worth of almond trees. And it's like, first off, if you're rich enough that you can pull out $14 million of almond trees, I do not feel sorry for you. Second, he said, he pointed to the almond trees that were remaining that he could still irrigate. He said, this is life. He pointed over to the almond trees that were coming out. This is death. And you know what's missing in this whole equation? The river.
Yeah.
This equation, listen to my language. You know what's missing from this story?
Yeah.
Is the river. The river is dead because he has $14 million, an excess $14 million of almond trees that he can cut. And then the fourth person, this is the reason I tell the story too, and this is all why we're not going to have a transformation, voluntary, is that Schwarzenegger, when they talked to him about it, he said, no, I support the fish 100%, and I support the farmers 100%. And the truth is, we can have it all. And he kept saying that over and over. He said, we can have it all. I'm sorry, cause and effect. Remember that? Remember that little thing you said you support about science? Remember that little thing about knowledge? Remember that thing about maybe if you do something, it might have an effect?
Mm-hmm.
There is only so much water. And if you take water from one place, it can't be in that original place anymore. And so, no, there won't be a voluntary transformation. And so the question becomes, if you care about life on the planet, if you care about the land where you live, if you care about frogs, if you care about migratory songbirds, if you care about swans, if you care about sturgeon, if you care about caribou, if you care about trout, if you care about anybody, human beings, then what are you going to do about it?
Yeah. You know, I'm always amazed by those kind of statements, like we can have it all, or we can find a way. And again, that goes back to the magical thinking. It's just that there's that complete separation. And as you said, you know, one minute we believe in science, and the next minute we're off in another world where we say we ignore the science to a degree. I mean,
absolutely. It's just, it's a sham. I mean, it's all just an argument it's all rationalization. There's another thing about, I mean, a question people have to ask is, has science been good for the world? Is the world better off because of the existence of science? Are salmon better off because science exists? Are, you know, name whomever you love. You know, are rockfish better off because of science?
Yeah.
And the answer is going to be no. No. Are black-footed ferrets better off because of science? Are indigenous humans better off because of science? No. Are humans better off because of science? Well, first off, who are we talking about? Are we talking about the subsistence farmers in India who are being driven off their land by Coca-Cola and by Monsanto?
No, definitely not.
Are we talking about indigenous people being driven off their land? We're talking about a relatively few number of people who are better off financially and who have, as one pro-slavery philosopher put it as to why you need to keep slavery, he said basically, where would we get our comforts or elegancies? I mean, the world is really being destroyed for comforts and elegancies. That's the bottom line. Comforts and elegancies for a few.
The other disconnect I see so often is when you see people talking about helping, quote, and I put that in quotes, the third world, is they're expecting them to have the same creature, you know, comforts that we have. And the same,
right.
Live the same way that we live. And they look at me really strange when I said, that's not possible.
No, it isn't possible.
You know,
it would
we live, they're in the condition they are in because we live the way we do.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, yoo-hoo. But anyway, it's a frustrating situation. And then you get in these conversations and, well, like you say, it's not. We're not going to get there. So, and as we've also said, so what does that mean in terms of our resistance?
Not to be a voluntary transformation. And if you care about life on the planet, what you need to do is you need to stop what is killing the planet.
Yeah.
And what seems pretty clear to me is killing. And what would we do if space aliens had come down and they had installed all this infrastructure? As space aliens were sucking oil out of the ground, burning it, and changing the climate, what would we do?
Of course we'd stop it.
And what would we do if space aliens were turning the land where you live into a moonscape? How would we stop it? You know?
Yeah.
I think it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
What would we do if the Soviets... What would the people of Canada do if the Soviets had invaded and were systematically doing this?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. They would have stopped it.
They would build a serious resistance movement.
Right. That's why how it works now, it's, I mean, here, I mean, the biggest reason why it's being turned into a landscape is because some Canadians are making a lot of money off of it. So, you know, if the space aliens, like in your book, if they offer the right amount of gold, then people will just turn around.
Well, and so what we need to think about is we need to perceive them as collaborators.
Yeah, exactly.
And the thing I want to end with is I really want to, and the most important thing, I think, is to ask yourself, where is your loyalty? And then to consciously figure out where you want your loyalty to be. I care more about salmon than I do about the continuation of this culture. And I care more about red-legged frogs and Pacific tree frogs than I do about the continuation of this culture or the government of California or the government of the United States or the government of ExxonMobil. And so that's a question, is figure out where your loyalties lie. What is it? There's a question. I mean, figure out what it is you want and then figure out how to get there.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason we always said, a lot of us don't know what we want. Well, I'm very clear on what I want. And what I want is I want to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before, and more frogs every year than the year before, and more newts every year than the year before, and more migratory songbirds every year than the year before. How do you get there? So what I would want people to do is I want them to figure out what they want, and then I want them to figure out how to get there.
That's a very good thing to add on.
Oh, great.
Good. Well, thank you very much, Derek, for your time.
Oh, thank you.
And I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, when you're ready. The reasons why this shit is normal. Pretend for a second that your life don't rely on the system we're all caught inside. Pretend you don't have to defend your side. What would that big picture look like? Here's what we won't and we don't and we can't understand. Goes back to the way that we stole this land. Anything based on conquest means that the product is all messed. What that means is we killed and we stole and we raped. Taking things that weren't ours to take. Building homes that weren't ours to make. And by association we still do it today to acquire the pieces we need to build. This way of life, I bet your God is thrilled about the free trade that enables your city to get made. That enslaves the world with debts unpaid. So the children are starving and you get an Escalade or a Dodge Stratus. The make and the model don't really matter. The point is things that the system brings. Anything from a car to a guitar string brought to you with prices beyond the tags. Entire families in body bags. Corporations and the government. The same thing where your tax money went. Put down all the revolutions. US-backed dictators doing all the shooting. Setting up a system to funnel it right back through the colonies and don't let them fight back. Perfected the method with Iraq. Started with a lie, it'll end with a greenback. Sanctions, bombs, and hate, we drop it all. Children amputate, a mother crawls for the money that our country's making all along. Some folks' job is to keep it all going on. Pretend that you just woke up tonight before tomorrow. Pretend you forgot all the reasons why this shit is normal. Pretend for a second that your life don't rely on the system we're all caught inside. Pretend you don't have to defend your side. What would that big picture look like? Army recruiter, next top model. Both are a big lie, both wanna take five. One makes you bleed and one makes you need them. Each one seeks you to thieve all your freedom. To live in this big world, freedom to love yourself without cover, girl. Take away our perspective. TV shows that time is collected. Fake news makes you think that you're caught up. Headlines corporate criminals thought up so that they can sell you their products. Starbucks, Nike, chocolate, or a Ford truck. All need people to die to get made. The way we do it, that's the way. that the system works, it's not a debate. If you open up your heart, your eyes see straight. But if we want what they're offering, we gotta sacrifice a moral life for more things. That's not how it has to be, but right now, we all practice catastrophe. Whether you know or not, every day, the animals, the earth, the poor, they all pay. Every day, every day, every day, every day. Imagine you wake up on a dirt floor. When the bombs drop, you're not hungry anymore. Why are we getting bombed when we're not at war? That's right, kids, North America wants more. They disconnect all the shit they buy from the way they collect the supplies. Word gets out and they rationalize. Questions don't make money, son, let it slide.
Tell me you just woke up tonight before tomorrow. Pretend you forgot all the reasons why this shit is normal. Pretend for a second that your life don't rely on the system we're all caught inside. Pretend you don't have to defend your side. What would that big picture look like?
And that was Filthy Politicians with Filthy Politicians. So taking us out is Sir X with You Got Me. A reminder to everyone that Deep Green Resistance is coming to Edmonton March 26th through 28th. And I'd love to see a really good turnout for that, because this is all about building a culture of resistance and how we go about doing that. So let's see a really good turnout in Edmonton for Deep Green Resistance. And remember, also, that the resistance needs you.